Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday afternoon, and it's time for all things political. Professor Julian Zelizer is our guest this hour. We have a lot to talk about. Donald Trump challenging the election's legitimacy in a tweet today. There have been many such tweets. Of course, he writes, there is large-scale voter fraud happening on and before Election Day. Why do Republican leaders deny what's going on? The third and final debate is this Wednesday. Will it just add to the stress that the American Psychological Association says over half of us are experiencing this election? Nine women have accused Donald Trump of groping, unwanted advances. Michelle Obama's speech stirs the nation's conscience. Most of our time, one person wrote over the weekend, is spent debating whether in the minds of most Democrats the next president could be a sexual predator, or in the minds of most Republicans, a woman married to a serial adulterer. That's the level of discourse these days. The New Republic has an interesting story about the WikiLeaks revelations, saying we should pay attention to the way power works in the Democratic Party. Who gets power matters as much as policy papers. In 2008, the power appears to be wielded by Wall Street. Democrats, according to the person who wrote the article, need some self-examination. Our guest this hour, Julian, will take us through 2016, what a year, and back to other ugly times in modern history when issues of race divided the Democratic Party. We'll be welcoming phone calls, and we'll take them fairly early on. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter as well, and that's at KDunn. Show. Professor Julian Zelizer is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and a New America Fellow. He is the author of a number of books, including books on presidents, The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. He also has written about conservatives in power, the Reagan years. He wrote a book on Jimmy Carter and books on Wilbur Mills, Congress and the State, and Arsenal of Democracy, the Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. Professor Zelizer, a pleasure to have you on the air again, sir. Hello.
Thanks for having me. Hello.
So how's the level of discourse in your classrooms? Are you talking about sex all the time, or are there other issues that students are interested in discussing?
I think students are more interested in discussing other issues, frankly.
Yeah. Good.
It's an interesting, I think there's a little bit of a backlash toward the kinds of stories that are out there, and the prevalence of those kinds of discussions leads some students, at least the ones I've encountered, to want to talk about what else is going on with this election.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about this election? I know that you've written about it. We can go back in time, and maybe we should early on, to a time when the Democratic Party was pretty fractured in the 1960s over civil rights. But I must tell you, I sort of remember some of that, but this is one wild election. It's just unbelievable.
It is. Obviously, at the top of the ticket, you have a personality who is almost, you could say he's pretty unique and unlike we've seen in American politics in terms of what he'll say, what he'll do, and the world in which he comes from. And so that makes it different. And there's also differences that have been building within the Republican Party, from the way the conservative media works to some of the organizations and groups that have become part of the Republican coalition, which are now at the forefront in this election, that I think are taking some people aback. That's not all about Trump. That's about the Republican Party. So all of this is a potent mix, and then add to it the Clintons and everything they bring to the table. And people are watching, I think, in disbelief sometimes, and others are watching with full engagement.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about this large-scale voter fraud that he tweeted about, and it's not just a tweet today. He's also talked about the election being rigged by the dishonest and distorted media pushing crooked Hillary. Also, he says, at many polling places, he's asked people to make sure things are on the up and up, to check their polling places. Where is he getting this? And does it resonate with many people? There really isn't a whole lot of voter fraud, is there?
There isn't. And we've had now many studies into voter fraud that began before Trump started making these allegations. The studies were actually a response to all the voter ID laws that are being put on the books in many states, including Wisconsin, to prevent fraud. And organizations, nonprofit organizations, have looked, and there's just really a handful of cases of fraud that have taken place. So this is more about politics than the data. And it's a very powerful argument. It raises questions about the legitimacy of how the process is working. It plays into conspiratorial fears sometimes that some voters have about how politics works in the United States. But it's not actually based on a long list of fraud. And it is not based on evidence that there is any concerted effort to literally rig the election in favor of one candidate over the other.
We do need to talk about these groping charges and statements about women and actions toward women. It certainly has dominated. Everybody knows about these now, like 96% of the American public, and it's really dominated political coverage, as you well know, during the course of the last week. I really believe that women are going to determine this election. When you look at these maps people have put out that shows if only women voted, Hillary Clinton would win almost every state. This is damaging to Donald Trump. Some are also saying it's not as damaging as people would have thought. It's not resulting in an increase in the number of people who say they will vote for Hillary Clinton. What's going on with that issue?
Well, women traditionally overall have voted in favor of the Democratic Party since the 1980s. There's been what we call the gender gap, and single women in particular vote very heavily Democratic, and many Republicans, Mitt Romney and John McCain, have struggled with this. And that's why some people in the GOP have said the party really needs to change its tune on issues related to gender. The place where Republicans have done well and better than the Democrats has to do with married women. And this has been a core source of support, suburban married women, for Republicans. And there's a lot of concern among Republicans that Trump himself, combined with the tape, combined with the allegations, will hurt on Election Day. We don't know whether that's the case. He has pulled terribly with women from the very beginning. Again, back in the primaries, this has been a source of vulnerability. This has to be balanced with the power of polarization in American politics, and that's something we're looking at. Is polarization so great, meaning Republicans won't vote for Democrats and vice versa under almost any circumstances, that whatever he does and whatever allegations surface, a large part of the Republican electorate would still rather vote for him than a Democrat?
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to a time that you've written about extensively. You remind us of 1968, George Wallace, when issues of race and Southern Democrats who broke away really from the party, and Hubert Humphrey's call to the convention in Philadelphia to say to the party that you need to get with this program. If not, why don't you leave? And indeed, they did leave over the issue of civil rights. It was a very divisive time in America.
It was very divisive. So Humphrey's speech is in 1948 at the Philadelphia Convention, right at the height of power for Southern Democrats in the party, and it all culminates in the late 1960s, where Southern Democrats are really starting to leave from the party for many reasons, including civil rights. So we've had really periods of bitter discord, and it wasn't simply race in the 60s, it was also Vietnam. The animosity that different factions of the debate had toward one another was extreme. And I think it's important to remember that. We've gone through periods that felt like the one we're going through today, in some ways even worse, because they didn't all revolve around one politician. They revolved around a set of issues that divided the nation. But we're in one of those contentious moments right now, and it's actually not just Trump. It's issues like immigration that have been at the forefront of this whole campaign. But we've had this before. We've also had moments when politicians play to the issue of race. George Wallace did this in 1968. The difference was he was a third-party candidate, whereas this year we've heard some of this with immigration in particular. But now, some say with race, through voter fraud allegations, we've heard it from the mainstream candidate.
You have said, though, that we have not had, when we look at Donald Trump, someone this, these are your words, brazen, this polemical, this openly angry, and in some ways willing to be vicious in their rhetoric that I can think of, at least in modern times.
I think that's true, and I've thought a lot about this because people are always asking me for what the historical precedent is, and what we've seen is there have been many politicians who've played on some of these divisions in society, but they've always felt the need when they were the candidate to contain their rhetoric. So some people argue Richard Nixon in 1968, when he talked about law and order, he was really talking about racial turbulence in the streets and playing to the white backlash that was starting to form. Some have argued in 1988, George H.W. Bush was using themes like the Willie Horton ad, the furlough program, to play on racial. But they did it still understanding that to win a broad coalition, this couldn't be front and center, and it had to be talked about in contained ways, whereas Donald Trump has thrown all of that away, and he's willing to say whatever's on his mind, make whatever accusations he wants to make, and even his demeanor and rhetoric is different. It's certainly not what we've seen from presidential candidates.
Mm-hmm. You also, and I'm glad that you made mention of this because this raised my eyebrows as well, his borderline anti-Semitic speech in Palm Beach where he suggested Hillary Clinton, and I quote, meets in secret with international banks to plot the destruction of U.S. sovereignty in order to enrich these global financial powers, her special interest friends, and her donors.
Look, this is not the first time this issue has come up. There have been many moments in the campaign where either anti-Semitic images have popped up in his own material, even though he said it wasn't what he intended to do or was put there by mistake. He's used anti-Semitic imagery most explicitly in this speech. And we know for a fact that many groups associated with what's called the alt-right, including white nationalist groups, like him very much. They see him as speaking to their concerns. We don't know what his intentions are. We don't know what he thinks about these issues, but I think it's been troubling to part of the electorate that we've seen this problem emerge so many times, and his use of some of this rhetoric, which can really inflame portions of the population.
Mm-hmm. The New Republic had an interesting article I just was reading today, and I'd like your thoughts about this. It was a writer who looked at what we've learned from WikiLeaks, and his take on this was, and I quote, Trump would legitimately be a terrifying leader of the free world, but there are consequences to the kind of home team political atmosphere that rejects any critical thought about your own side. And he talks about a guy who's now a U.S. trade rep who was at the time an executive at Citigroup who came up with a list of women for top administrative jobs in the Obama administration. And, you know, it's pretty much down the line, all his recommendations seem to become a reality, which makes you wonder who's got control of some parts of government and if the Democrats shouldn't be doing some more self-examination about all of this.
I think that's very important. There's beyond this election, I think the issue that emerged in the primaries had to do with just that. What are the problems with the Democratic Party? What are some of the structures within which the party operates that limit their vision, that allow powerful interests to have a big role in the political process? And where has the party fallen short in its promise to be responsive and to include the voices of working and middle-class Americans? All those are really big issues. They've been around, and it's been a question for a while. This was part of what animated Obama's campaign in 2008. And there will be a temptation if Donald Trump loses and Hillary Clinton has the success some anticipate in the election to not look at that, not look inward.
Mm-hmm.
Because the focus is so hard to remove from Donald Trump. But it would be a mistake because I think there are real problems and questions there that Democrats need to wrestle with.
And millennials are concerned about. You've also said that you're worried that a lot of the people you teach, millennials, will not be voting in this election. They're concerned about that very issue, aren't they?
That's a big issue, and it's a big question. Right now, Hillary Clinton's strategy is in many ways to fade away,
mm-hmm.
to let Donald Trump be Donald Trump and not to say anything because there's no need to make herself part of the story. But the risk is that all the coalition that she wants to come and vote for her and the voters she wants to engage not only in her campaign but in a potential presidency, including millennials, won't really know what she's about. Or when this election ends, they'll barely remember the victor, ironically, because everyone's so focused on the person who might lose, if that's the way this unfolds. And I think there's a risk there. So we don't know. Millennials don't vote in high numbers. We don't know how they're going to vote. They're not thrilled about Hillary Clinton. That's been clear from the polling from the very beginning. But I think it's a danger for her, and it's a danger for the Democratic Party. They need a party that speaks to the next generation of voters, not just to the last couple of generations. Mm,
yeah, that's interesting. So if you were advising her about Wednesday night, to tell you the truth, I don't know if I can bear to watch another one of these. I've never said this. I love politics, but oh, my gosh. If you were advising her to really do a knockout punch on Wednesday night, what would you have her do, Jillian?
I don't know. If I was advising her on what to do, my suggestion would be to use this last moment in the national spotlight to talk about what her presidency would mean for the country and what she wants to fight for in the next 4 years. I think there's limits on what she can do to, quote-unquote, knock him out, because he is someone who survives and almost thrives in some of the ugliness of American politics, and certainly the fighting only inspires him. It doesn't demoralize him. So I think her best bet is really to continue letting him do his thing, but to show herself as a contrast to him in terms of being a leader, but also to let the country know what it would mean to have her in office, as opposed to making it 90 minutes about, you know, what tirade her opponent can go on because of a given question. Mm.
Well, she should have made that case by now, shouldn't she?
She should have. And it's a vulnerability. It's a flaw in the campaign. And it has been. It's something she's had trouble doing. And so the time is late. But if she wants to use those minutes wisely, I still think that's the best. But you can't engage in a back and forth with him, that kind of a street fight, and come out the winner. I think everyone who's tried to do that has lost. The best bet is to take the attention away from the kind of antics that he likes to use politically to advance himself.
Mm-hmm. Or to call him out on moral grounds, which Michelle Obama, I got to say, that was one important and very powerful speech.
It is. And I think Michelle Obama's in a place that's easier for her to do it than Hillary Clinton, both because of who she is, and also because she is outside the formal election process. I think it was a speech that really moved certainly many Democrats and articulated some of the feeling that many Democrats have watching this debate, and many Republicans, frankly, watching this campaign. But I think that's going to be hard for Hillary Clinton to do because of the baggage that she has, but also because she's in the room with him. And he won't just let you sit and make a speech like that. He'll try to drag you down into more of a street fight.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Professor Jillian Zelizer is our guest this hour, and it's all things political that you're listening to. He joins us from fairly often here for this discussion. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton and a New America Fellow. He does a regular column for CNN, and in case you watch CNN, he is a frequent contributor to CNN as well. He's the author of Jimmy Carter, The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society, and many other books. Our phone number, we have a line open if you'd like to join the conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter @KDunnShow. We'll be back and take your calls momentarily. We mentioned Michelle Obama's speech, in case you didn't hear that speech in New Hampshire last week. Here's just a portion of it before we go to your phone calls.
And I know it's a campaign, but this isn't about politics. It's about basic human decency. It's about right and wrong. And we simply cannot endure this or expose our children to this any longer, not for another minute, and let alone for 4 years. Now is the time for all of us to stand up and say, enough is enough. This has got to stop right now. Because consider this. If all of this is painful to us as grown women, What do you think this is doing to our children? What messages are our little girls hearing about who they should look like, how they should act? What lessons are they learning about their value as professionals, as human beings, about their dreams and aspirations? And how is this affecting men and boys in this country? Because I can tell you that the men in my life do not talk about women like this, and I know that my family is not unusual.
The attacks have been personal and at times surprising.
I think it's disgraceful, and I think she should be ashamed of herself, if you want to know the truth.
Anything to avoid talking about your campaign and the way it's exploding and the way Republicans are leaving you.
Clinton and Trump debate for a third and final time. Will they sway voters when they meet in Las Vegas? I'm Robert Siegel. Join me Wednesday for special coverage of the final presidential debate from NPR News.
Wednesday night at 8 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Professor Julian Zelizer is with us this hour, and we go to Patrick in Richland, our first caller. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, another great show, Kathleen. Thank you.
Thanks, Patrick.
Hillary's going to win. It's just a question of how much. I mean, after all, Bernie's campaign, if it reassured us of anything, that most of our fellow Americans really do value our civilized society and things that come along with it. So that part's probably... But isn't this an opportunity right here for the Democrats to really get out front and use the same decency that appealed with, like, what Bernie was saying? And, for instance, I don't know if the professor's aware, Kathleen, or not, but, you know, our governor some years ago told one of his top fundraisers, it's on, you know, video, that he was going to use a divide-and-conquer strategy to get past his controversial legislation. Now, after what Trump has done, divided and conquered the Republican Party so successfully, why would anybody want him in charge of the country? But anyway, isn't it time for our state Democrats to, like, get their head out of the foxhole and just explain to us, divide and conquer? Who are we dividing? Who are we conquering? And who are we doing this dividing and conquering on behalf?
Thank you so much for your call, Patrick. Professor Zelizer.
Well, I think divide and conquering means several things at this moment. One, it will refer to the kind of politics we're engaging at, and that might be a little different than the caller meant. But I do think some people have been a little bit upset or taken aback by the divisiveness of the current political rhetoric that we see. But the other issue that's emerged are using and exploiting divisions in the party. That's actually something else I think has become quite interesting. For years, we keep hearing about how there's no divisions within the party. Both parties are pretty united and then just hate each other. But one thing that's emerged certainly with Donald Trump is there are deep divisions within the Republican Party. And the question is if Democrats can exploit it. Hillary Clinton has tried very hard, and we'll see the outcome in November, to win Republican votes in places where we thought that was impossible as a result of having Donald Trump as the opponent. We've seen many Republican elites come out against Trump, but we don't know if a divide-and-conquer strategy will work with the electorate. We just don't know. There's some indication many Republicans, even if they don't like Donald Trump, will still vote Republican. So it's an open question, but I think it could be an essential tactic for Hillary Clinton if there's any evidence in November of splits that are actually having an effect.
Where do you think things stand at the moment? The polls, they're all over the place. Some are showing that nationally she may have as much as an 11-point lead. Some are saying 4 points. Some are saying 7 points. CNN poll out today, Trump has the edge in Ohio. She's ahead in Nevada and North Carolina, and she's thinking of going to places like Arizona, very red states. Where do you see them at the moment?
Overall, if you look at the polls, the aggregates of the polls, it looks good for Hillary Clinton. It's hard not to see that although there's evidence in a few battleground states like Ohio that he's still doing well, and there's evidence in a lot of Republican states like Missouri that they're not changing their vote because of anything they've seen from him. This was always a contest where she didn't have to win that many battleground states, and he had to win lots of them. That's the basic fact to win this election, and right now he's not. And there's just not evidence that he's moving in the right direction. So at this point, if you're just looking at the numbers, she clearly is the favorite to win. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know if there's more WikiLeaks coming out. We don't know if the polls somehow are not telling us the truth because of people not responding accurately.
Mm-hmm.
But most are in agreement that he is, at this point, an underdog to win this election.
Patrick, thanks for your call. David in Michigan is next. Hi, David.
Yeah. Talking about voter fraud, the real voter fraud is not the people voting. It's these voter ID laws disfranchising all these voters and stuff. I mean, that's what I consider fraud.
Professor Zelizer.
He's not alone on that. And there's been a lot of criticism about the voter ID laws that are now all over the country, particularly after the Supreme Court knocked down the Voting Rights Act, a key part of it, of 1965, and states like Texas started to become much more aggressive in implementing these. There isn't a lot of evidence of voter fraud, yet there has been a pretty significant expansion of laws that make the vote more difficult, require more forms of ID, start to eliminate same-day registration, all the mechanisms that we've put into place to do what we thought we wanted people to do, vote, have been undercut in many states. And there are many observers watching to see how this plays out. And the worry is not only does this limit the number of people who are going to vote, but it hits disadvantaged communities worse than others because they don't always have the kind of ID that's required. And that's why when the talk of voter fraud emerges, it's a bit disconcerting for many observers, since the other part of this story is a much bigger issue.
David, thanks for your call. Jim is next in Galesville. Hi, Jim.
Thank you for taking my call. Sure. Wonderful program. I'd like to ask your guest how much culpability the Republican Party, for lack of a better word, establishment, I do hate that word, but has in actually creating Donald Trump. The politics of fear that have been exercised go, gosh, back to probably W's first run and the lead up to this mess in the Middle East. I mean, how much, and the birther movement and not stamping that down right away, saying this is not the case, but just let it foment for, you know, the entire two terms of the Obama administration. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the call, Jim.
I believe I speak to groups often, and one of the topics is often, where does Donald Trump come from? And I believe that's a very valid point, that Donald Trump did not emerge out of nowhere, nor was he just a TV star who decided to run and did well. He grows out of certain elements of Republican politics that have been becoming stronger over the years. So one development we've seen and we've talked about is the expansion and proliferation of a conservative media that has pushed forward a certain kind of in-your-face dialogue of discourse, debate about politics, and promoted certain themes like the birther movement. We've seen the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party become stronger in Congress and also promote an anti-establishment approach to politics, which I think often resembles a lot of what we're hearing from Donald Trump. And some of the elements, the more controversial elements of his campaign, such as a hardline position on immigration, come directly out of important and significant coalitions in the Republican Party. So while he is a unique figure and he has taken a lot of this to places no one anticipated, this comes out of part of this party. And so I think when the election is over, whatever the results are, there will be a lot of, or there should be a lot of introspection if Republicans are really unhappy with the candidate that they had.
I had somebody, I can't remember who it was, we've done so many political shows, I remember the moment, the whole birther thing was just so ridiculous, and it went on forever, and the fact that he could get any attention at all, Julian, from that was appalling to me, but I remember the moment at the White House Correspondents' Dinner when President Obama really took him to task for that, and you could tell how uncomfortable he was, and someone said, I think one of the reasons that he ran for president big time this go around is because he wanted to conduct the ultimate revenge against the black man, President Obama, who had put him down.
Yeah, my sense from at least trying to learn more about his origins is these aspirations go beyond that moment. And this is much more than a candidate trying to get revenge on someone who humiliated him. Even his involvement in the birther movement was very much an effort, a two-year effort, to move from the world of television to the world of politics and gain a national platform. So I think he's been more ambitious than we understood politically. I think he's been thinking about this for a while. There's evidence that goes back even earlier where he's toyed with the idea of running for the presidency, and he's thought about when the right moment would be. And he didn't really think it was in 2012, and this was a moment where he saw his own party, or the Republican Party, as vulnerable because of the candidate mix that existed. So I think this is bigger than that. And I think what if he doesn't win, I don't think he's simply going to fade from the political scene. I'm not sure how he will try to influence it, but I don't think he's going away.
Yeah, who knows what's next. Yeah, let's talk a little more about the media. You have said that the media didn't create Donald Trump, but he knew how to exploit the media.
He sure did. I'm not one who subscribes to the notion that somehow the reporters and producers and everyone just wanted to cover him because he was a good story that gained viewers and readers. I think there's much more to his rise to power and his success than that. But he's exploited the media well. He understood that when you have so much political news out there, there was a need and desire for story, for content, as it's called in our modern vocabulary, and he has constantly provided that. That's part of what he does when he throws out controversial statements and makes claims out of nowhere. He is giving the media something to cover. He also does it in a way that works in our internet clickbait media, where things can be summarized and explained within a few words, and often that is the kind of way in which he tells his tale. And finally, he's very good at thinking about how the media will cover a given moment. He likes to distract reporters. He likes to move conversations from one place to another, often in abrupt fashion, often in very controversial fashion, but he's done that well again and again. And he's thought of the whole campaign as a story, almost as a reality show. And I think sometimes it's deliberate the way he structures himself, not just as a candidate, but as a character. I don't think it's going to work. It's not going to bring him the victory. That's my instinct, or at least my evaluation of what I'm seeing. But I think he's understood a lot about the media. He's also, with Twitter, just to conclude on this, understood the way in which candidates can now reach voters
yes.
directly. They don't need the intermediary institution always of the media at all.
Paul sends this email. My stress this election season is about the Affordable Care Act, under which, he says, I, as an independent individual, have been purchasing health insurance. The news coming out about next year's plan offerings is pretty dismal. Is the ACA done for as far as offering affordable, effective plans? Are there any scenarios that could change this? For example, is it really on Hillary Clinton's radar? If we get a Democratic executive and a Republican-dominated Congress, does the ACA continue to be neglected as far as actually insuring the otherwise uninsured?
There has been a lot of problems to emerge with ACA, and it's a story that we're not following because it's taking place in the context of the election, and because the Republican nominee, even though this has been such a big issue, has really put it on the back burner. Obamacare is not something that you hear all the time, as we did just a few years ago or even in 2012. But I think it's a big issue. This is clearly a program that needs to be fixed. It's a program that needs care. This is not unique. Many of our most successful programs weren't so successful early on. It often required are years of building and tinkering and revamping things that go wrong. But it's unclear that's going to happen because it's true. As the email says, we very well might have a Democratic president and a Republican Congress. And in the House, the Republicans might be more conservative than they are today and with a narrower majority, which means they will not be up for fixing the ACA. They are happy to let it continue to struggle.
Paulette in Turtle Lake, hi.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, I feel this way. I've been involved with voting for many years now, and I really have never seen any Democrat do anything that they said they were going to do when they were elected. And same goes for the Republican Party. And I believe that's why Donald Trump is the one that the people actually wanted for on the Republican Party, because he isn't somebody that could be bought. He isn't going to be swayed by special interests. And that's, he doesn't feel like somebody owes it to him like Hillary does. I think it's terrible what she did to get Bernie out of the race, and she would have been better off winning that race on her own without the dirty politics that
so
was involved.
Who are you voting for, Pauletta?
I am voting for Donald Trump all the way.
Okay. Professor Zelizer.
I mean, I think there's three interesting issues in that comment. The first has to do with the perception that Donald Trump is independent and wouldn't be someone who's bought. That's not clear. And I think there are many people who've pushed back on the storyline that he himself likes to promote. And even in his business, he has been very connected to many interests, from political interests, who he's tried to lobby, to overseas, areas where he does business, where he's worked with governments overseas. There's questions of, is he the independent person we think of? He's received donations from conservatives. He's not wholly doing this on his own, and it's unclear he would be such a maverick once he was in the White House. The second issue is really important. There are many Americans who feel the government and the parties aren't working, and I think this was important to Donald Trump's rise. It's not simply about the arguments he makes, but it's about some of the failures of Washington that come from the role of money in politics to the impact of gridlock that led to more suspicion and distrust of all political leaders in both parties and made it much harder for the Jeb Bushes of the world or the Marco Rubios of the world to say that you shouldn't take him seriously, because many Americans don't take them or Washington seriously. Hmm. So these are some fundamentals, again, that we need to look at some of these problems after the election is over. And obviously Hillary Clinton will face this ongoing struggle to get people to trust her, because there are many Democrats who in the primaries did not want her to be the nominee and who continue to express low levels of trust even when they like her more than Donald Trump. She might get through the election because of who she faces, but once she is president, if she is president, she would need to establish some level of enthusiasm and confidence within the Democratic Party if she wants to govern in what will be an incredibly contentious environment.
It sure will be. Jenny on Twitter says, Trump is the worst thing that's happened to this country in my 62 years. He's destroying us even without being in office.
Well, there's many who feel that way. There's many who don't. There's many who like what he has to offer and think that he offers a better way forward. But I do think there's many in the country, in both parties, who don't feel this is the best American politics has to offer. And so one question is, if after Trump, whether he's president or whether he's no longer the president, do we move to a better place? Or going back to earlier in the conversation, do we have to dig deeper? Is this coming from somewhere? And is American politics not as pretty as we like to think? And if that's the case, we need to look at some of the underlying causes that allowed for the Donald Trump candidacy to take place. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we will recreate it in some other form.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of whoever wins, the Congress they're going to face, what kind of Congress are they going to face, do you think, Julian? Is the Senate, do you think, standing a good chance of going Democratic or not?
Well, the Senate is still up in the air, and There's certain places where Democrats hope to pick up seats, like Florida and Missouri and Indiana in particular. I was thinking with Evan Bayh, but it doesn't look like they're going to win in some of those contests. Rubio looks like he's going to win. Bayh looks like he's going to lose. So right now, from the people who follow the horse races of the Senate, it's unclear, but there's a decent chance the Republicans will keep control, even with the Trump effect. The House, the Democrats are not likely to gain a majority, but they will narrow the size of the Republican majority, possibly by 20 seats. The problem is, for Democrats, that what we're looking at is the Freedom Caucus, the Tea Party coalition, is probably going to grow in size. So you're going to have a speaker, whether it's Paul Ryan or someone else, who has a narrower majority, but a much stronger Freedom Caucus. So they are going to have to move to the right, and that's where the pressure is going to be. So you will still have a very conservative Congress, frankly, even if the Democrats are able to get a narrow lead in the Senate.
Professor Julian Zelizer, our guest for All Things Political, welcoming phone calls. We have one line open, so get it right now. 800-486-8655 is the number. He has been with us many times. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and a New America Fellow. He's a presidential historian, having written books on Jimmy Carter, on Lyndon Johnson, Congress and the Battle for the Great Society, on Ronald Reagan, and has written other books as well. He does a weekly column, op-ed actually, for CNN, and he's on TV on CNN quite a bit as well. More phone calls momentarily here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls for Julian Zelizer, and Ross is next. Hi, Ross.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my phone call.
Sure.
This has been a great discussion. My question is in regards to the third debate. I feel like most people have their minds made up so far already on who they're going to vote for, and it would be in my opinion that her strategy needs to be, she needs to be presidential and those straight issues, talk about nothing but what she wants to do to, you know, and build off the last 8 years, and then completely ignore Trump. I think he's going to try to attack her, he's going to try to drag her through the mud, and if she engages him in that type of debate, I think she would lose. But I think if she stayed presidential calm and just ignored everything he said, I really think she would come out and maybe get those last few voters that are undecided. And I wanted to see what your guess thought about that.
Thank you, Ross. Thanks for your comments.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think one contrast she obviously wants to draw is not about anything she says, but this has been an issue for months now. It's to contrast her temperament and her demeanor, to make the argument that the person across the stage isn't fit to be president, and I am. And so she wants to continue to do that, and she wants to not engage in just being a rougher Trump. Rather, she wants to offer something different. But she still also needs to use this time to talk about some of her ideas, because people don't just want a president who acts in a better way than the opponent. They want someone who can lead them and lead the country in a certain direction. But the caller is absolutely right. The one thing she doesn't want to do is to get in a back and forth with him over whatever scandals or issues or arguments he's going to put out there.
Mm. It's almost hard to watch these at this point, at least for me. I just sit there and go, oh, no, you know, please, could we just elevate all of this? Could we just elevate it just as much as possible? Because it's the rhetoric, the whole aspiration for something better for the country seems to be, the inspiration isn't there. You want somebody to kind of inspire you, don't you?
No, it's true. And you want to have some confidence in the people who have power in the country. And I think this has been difficult to watch. You turn it on, and I think at some level you're hoping it's not going to be what I think it's going to be. And it then is even worse. That's certainly what we've seen in the last and the second debate, which was pretty shocking.
Right. Yeah.
But my guess is we're going to have more of the same.
Yeah, and not be shocked by it anymore.
That's true. That's probably the biggest danger, isn't that we just have more of this, that we become numb to it. And
right.
And that's something people are wondering. Does this become the new normal? And what happens in the next election cycle if you've seen the places that a candidate can take these kinds of attacks? Why won't the next candidate replicate this? if he loses and his loss is not severe, which some people think might be the outcome, you know, there's going to be an incentive to replicate some of this.
Ross, thanks for your call. Ray in Milwaukee, hello.
I'm not voting this election. This is the first election I won't vote for in a presidential election out of the last 8 cycles, I believe. And let me explain why. Both parties are representing the worst parts of American politics. The Democrats gave us Hillary, which will be a continuation of Obama, drone bombing, exporting illegals back home to their country. Obama has broken all records with his ICE campaign, going in at 3 and 4 in the morning to families and ripping out the husbands and mothers and putting them in internment camps. And then you have the Republicans, which hate American workers, actually. And let me remind you, what reason would Hillary Clinton go to Donald Trump's wedding? It's insider politics 101. They both represent the worst parts of our government.
All right, Ray, thanks for your call. Professor Zelizer.
Well, those are the feelings that certainly Hillary Clinton's supporter team should be worried about. They don't want to have a depressed vote based on the assumption she's going to win. They don't want a depressed vote because many people believe there's no difference between the parties. And this is the danger of not highlighting what's at stake. I think the Clinton team would say, you might not love us, and certainly we're not outsiders, but there's some pretty big fundamental differences in the kinds of policies you would get under one president versus the other, and then the kind of leadership you would have with one candidate over the other. So even if you don't love me, there's still a lot of reason to vote for me. And they need to make that case, and it's pretty important. They don't want to make the mistake of just assuming everyone will see what in their mind is the obvious choice, because there are many voters who feel this way, and they're probably turned off even more after the kinds of debates that they're seeing.
Mm-hmm. Janet sends this email. Is it a coincidence that the first female candidate from a major party is opposed by someone who minimizes the worth of women, also is becoming arguably the most powerful leader in the world, not a logical progression of Trump's aspirations?
No, gender has been front and center in this campaign, and it's not a surprise that when you have the first female nominee of a major party, running against her is someone who's running a very male-centric campaign,
mm-hmm.
a campaign that appeals to white men, being a certain version of what they imagine a man should be. And I think some of his attacks, even if they're not explicitly about gender, are just about that. And he's a candidate who's openly mocked women and made very, you know, degrading statements.
Right, horrible.
So I think these two go hand in hand, and I think that's part of his support might come from some of the sexism that still exists in the electorate.
Tom in Rhinelander, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Professor, finally, I was a little shocked that when you started to talk about the divide and conquer, that the professor went right away to sort of the Republicans who may be willing to support Hillary, because I think that one of the most recent callers there saying he's not going to vote. This is what I'm seeing as the prominent issue for the Democrats. Bernie Sanders would be the nominee right now if Hillary was not a woman. And, you know, and yet the Democratic Party seems to be ignoring the disaffection of this huge group.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm supporting her, and I supported Bernie, but I think if she doesn't come out and really hammer some issues that are important to that demographic in this debate, she's going to have a very close election. And what's going to happen is the down ballot Senate and the House mm-hmm. are not going to turn over.
Tom, valid points, I think. Julia.
Yeah, I mean, the one place I would disagree is I don't think she defeated him just because she's a woman. The campaign was very effective on many levels and included a lot more than that. That said, I think it's absolutely true. The Democrats have some pretty big divisions, and there's this underlying frustration with the way this economy has taken shape. And you could imagine someone different than Donald Trump, who had a much more coalitional and expansive vision of campaigning, to actually attract some of the Democrats who are expressing their frustration, not only with Clinton, but with their own party. He's not going to do that. I don't think you're going to see a lot of Democrats go that way on the economic issues, but it's a vulnerability, and it is a division and a tension within the Democratic Party that it would be a mistake to ignore just because you end up with a victory by the Democrat.
Yeah. Julian Zelizer, always a great pleasure to speak with you. Happy election season, sir.
Thank you.
Thanks. Professor Julian Zelizer, our guest, professor of history, public affairs at Princeton University, frequent commentator on CNN. He also writes a weekly op-ed. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour, and thanks to Zeb Gozman for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. News is coming up, and we'll return with the question, would you take time or money?